From WNYC, New York Public Radio, this is the Leonard Lopate Show. I'm Leonard Lopate, and this is just one segment of our show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open from American Express, presenting the interactive webcast event, Making a Name for Yourself. Kate and Andy Spade and Bobby Brown discuss their leap from business to brand, created by Open from American Express. Registration at openforumonline.com. You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
When the weather gets this oppressive, most people can't wait to get away from it all. But what does a vacation mean for you? Vacationers tend to be divided into two types, those who just want to veg out and those who can't squeeze enough activities into their time away from work. So we decided to consult a man who's devoted his professional life to pondering the significance of vacations, Jeff Godby, a professor of leisure studies at Pennsylvania State University, and I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show. Hello.
How are you?
I'm well. What does a professor of leisure studies mean? Are you the only one?
No, actually, there's curriculums in a number of universities that study what people do during their time away from work and how it affects their health, how it affects the economy. And, you know, if you think about it for more than 10 seconds, it's one of those labels that sounds funny, like solid waste management, you know. Mm-hmm. But if you think about it, what people do in their free time is often as important and sometimes more important than what they do at work.
How long have you been doing this? And are you how long has leisure studies actually been going on?
Leisure studies in the U.S. has been going on probably 50 years.
Really?
There was great fear in the 20s and 30s that as people began to get some free time, that they wouldn't know what to do with it, and that, you know, society would simply fall apart. And in cities like yours, New York City, there were huge reform movements to try to show people, you know, in their time away from work, what they could do that might have meaning and be pleasurable to them. And so it's a kind of surprising field.
So it was important for us to have academics telling us what we should do in our downtime?
No, not at all. It's not a prescriptive kind of field, but it does happen that there are some uses of leisure that for most people seem to be more satisfying. And that's not to, you know, be prescriptive, but in terms of impact on health and on happiness, there's kind of a hierarchy that actually emerges, and so I have no idea what you should do with your free time, but we do know some things that satisfy people, like skill challenge, forms of leisure, contact with nature, socialization. We know those things, you know, on average, tend to be more beneficial than for instance, being perpetually entertained or perpetually stoned.
Well, what about just lying on the beach without doing much else? Is relaxation and little more a good thing or a bad thing? Where does it fit in the hierarchy?
Well, it's a really good thing. However, in terms of where it would fit in the hierarchy, it's pretty low. If you have a lot of harm done to you at your work, there's, you know, hot water, lying on the beach, getting a little sun, you know, laying around is really beneficial. But if you're a luckier person, you know, the search for recovery from work goes to the search for pleasure and ultimately the search for meaning, because lucky people get to kind of describe who they are and become more complex by how they use their free time.
And is that why some people choose to use their free time running around trying to experience things that they might not experience otherwise?
Yeah. You know, at its worst, leisure doesn't tell you anything about the world. It's just recovery or escape or catharsis. And again, there, you know, depending on the situation you're in, that may be just what you need. A lot of people who work in coal mines and mind-numbing retail, you know, need escape, need to kind of repair themselves. But, you know, you can go up the hierarchy from that. A lot of people don't basically learn much about who they are or the world they live in during their free time.
Well, is running around a lot relaxing, or is it just another form of work?
Well, at their best, work and leisure have some things in common. And in a kind of German sense of a work, doing something significant. And that significant may be a garden or learning to play the violin or learning something about impressionism in art or, you know, things that make you more complex. Basically, in your leisure, you're getting more complex or less complex. You're getting smarter or stupider. And there's a lot of evidence of this. There's a lot of actual scientific evidence that what you do in your leisure is stunningly important in terms of, you know, your own personal development.
In fact, you've said at the end of your life, what you've done with your leisure may be more important than what you've done at work. That despite the fact that most Americans tend to define themselves by their work?
They do, although if, you know, if they're achievement-oriented and you look at some vitas these days or resumes, you'll see a lot of leisure achievement. You know, I'm a master chef. I'm a white belt or black belt in karate. But one of the things that separates us, you know, assumedly from other animals is that we can experience personal freedom and we're not programmed like other animals. And, you know, given time, what's worth doing? That's a very old question. It's a question that comes to us from ancient Athens. Given a minimum of constraints, what is worth doing? And that seems to me to, you know, to be a fairly critical question.
My guest is Jeff Godby, a professor of leisure studies at Pennsylvania State University. Later, we'll be taking some of your calls at 212-433-9692. When did the concept of vacations actually arise? I would assume that the wealthy have always had the option of taking time off.
Yeah, and in most cultures, it's been the wealthy and the powerful that have been able to do that or even to have a perpetual vacation. You know, vacations were part, in more, you know, in more recent history, vacations were part of the labor movement's demands and requests. And, of course, the U.S. remains unique among all modern nations. We have no federal legislation that requires that any employer give any vacation to an employee.
Yet I would have thought that vacations would have been part of the American dream, that everyone would have the opportunity to have a vacation.
I would have thought that too, but unlike every other modern nation, which averages, even Canada, which averages from 19 to 50 days of vacation a year, in the U.S. we average about 12 in terms of the days people actually take. And our legislation, the Fair Labor Standards Act, just doesn't say anything about vacations. You know, the period. You know, this is an unusual country. It's both obsessed with seeking pleasure and puritanical at the same time. And on our legislation, Puritanism and the business community won out.
Well, it's my sense that people are vacationing less now than they did in the past. I remember a time when New Yorkers with fairly modest incomes would spend the summer in resort areas like the Catskills and the Jersey Shore, and the father might shuttle back and forth on weekends for part of that time, but also would spend a couple of weeks with the family.
Yeah, I I think some of that is still in place. And, you know, for New Yorkers, that could now extend into the Poconos and Pennsylvania and quite a distance. But there seems to be less of it. You know, the economy has been rationalized, and there are lots of people who are afraid to take vacations or voluntarily, quote, voluntarily give back some of their vacation days. And I agree with you, it's not like it used to be. The slowdown that took place in summer historically, and a slowdown in the middle of winter, which was, while it was Christmas-based, it was still a, you know, a period in which work subsided. That seems to be somewhat missing.
Is that why it's so hard for some people to choose what to do and where to go on their vacations, because they now are giving it less time, so the vacation takes on a lot more significance for them?
Yeah, it does. There's often an attempt to kind of concentrate a whole lot of, you know, we only have 5 days and we're in England, so we're going to see everything. And part of that carries over from the pace of work and the rationalization of work and the impatience that characterizes, you know, impatience and efficiency, desire for efficiency, characterize this country to a stunning extent. And just to wander, just to be somewhere and drift in a direction that time takes you is just basically a foreign idea.
That's why so many people come back from the vacation. They say, I'm more tired than I was when I left.
In many cases, that's true, although there's a body of evidence that says that in vacations, while part of vacations can be onerous, that people recover the ability to concentrate and also put their own life in some kind of perspective from being somewhere else, from living a different existence for a week or 2 weeks, that they see the world that they have lived in and will live in again in a very different way, and I think that's meaningful.
If someone were to tell you that he just couldn't decide what to do on a vacation, what recommendations would you give to help him come up with an answer?
Well, you know, I don't know that I would have... the only thing I can say is that the ability to do everything, you know, the old idea of leisure was that you willingly sacrificed a bunch of activities and behaviors that might be pleasurable and desirable for the one that you thought was superior. And so the idea of vacation or the idea of leisure ultimately means you sacrifice a whole lot of things that might be fun, that might be, you know, enjoyable, to really give yourself, I'm going to see one area of London, you know. I'm going to see one small town in the Pennines for a week. I'm not leaving the town. I'm going to find out something about it. And so I guess that's the only thing I would say is, you know, is what Walt Whitman, actually what a bunch of American critiquer said, simplify, simplify.
My guest is Jeff Godbey, G-O-D-B-E-Y, a professor of leisure studies at Pennsylvania State University. We'll take a little break and come back with more and your calls here at 212-433-9692. Stay with us. We're back with Jeff Godbey, a professor of leisure studies at Pennsylvania State University. And in a moment, we'll be taking your calls at 212-433-9692. Professor Godbey, I understand you've been going to China to consult with people there about vacations.
Yeah. Believe it or not, in urban China, not in rural China, where life is almost all work, in urban China right now, there are three what they call golden weeks. In those 3 weeks, the system shuts down. In effect, the Chinese, urban Chinese, have while they work long hours, they have more vacation time than we do.
That seems to be the case throughout Asia. We've always thought of the Japanese as people who worked harder than the rest of us, and yet the Japanese seem to have built vacations into their lifestyles.
Yeah, I've spent a lot of my academic career doing time research with a guy named John Robinson, having thousands and thousands of people keep time diaries. How do they actually use their time? And the conclusion we've come to over 30 years is that it's not that Americans don't have any free time. It's that the way it's distributed is pretty dysfunctional. Most of our free time comes on weekdays, and it comes in small chunks of an hour and a half, 45 minutes. It's good for a rerun of Seinfeld, but in terms of discovering who you are, it's not worth much.
Let's take some calls. Elizabeth from Jersey City. Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. I just wanted to give you, we're talking about free time and leisure time almost only in the form of vacation. And as you just said, you know, what do we do with all those small chunks? And I was just saying to your screener that I was raised by my grandmother, who was born at the turn of the century. So television was something that we only were allowed to watch so much of. And it didn't feel like I was being allowed and not allowed. It's just that my time was filled up with different things. My brother played an instrument, and I was given art supplies. And, you know, we did things with our free time. And I used to work at a museum, and I started my own little sort of survey of asking children if any of them, you know, had hobbies, or if their parents, if anyone sewed or knit or made their own clothes. And almost always people, no one does anything anymore.
Well, is that totally true, Professor Godbey? Perhaps they're just doing different things. When kids are playing video games, is that all that different from what we were doing when we were kids?
Well, certainly video games are a kind of skill challenge form of leisure that replaced, you know, pinball machines and other types of skill challenge leisure. But I think the caller has hit on something, that a lot of leisure for both adults and adolescents in this society is entertainment that is being entered and contained. And if I ask my class, you know, how many of you play music, they think I mean an iPod, you know, not a trumpet. Yeah, and it's amazing to me in many cases how much of leisure for all of us is being entered and contained.
Well, some people do still keep their work with them. I just went to a film the other day. The guy in the row in front of me had his BlackBerry open until the very last second. I was worried that he was going to keep it open throughout the film because it glows. But there are people who take their BlackBerries with them. You know, they take their BlackBerries with them on their vacations, and they're, even if they're on the beach, they're working, aren't they?
Yeah, and when I become king, he will be forced to eat it.
You think that's bad?
Sure. I mean, it first is bad taste. The person is in public, and you know, needs to recognize that. It's one of the terrible things about cell phone is they've made being in public disappear.
Yeah.
I was in an airport last week, and a guy was cursing into his cell phone, and there were two elderly women across from him, and I glared at him, and he finally said to me, What? And I said, "You're in public, you know. You are in public, and the women across from you may not, you know, like your language." And he hadn't thought about that because he didn't see that there was any, you know, he was in his own little world.
Well, they also talk about very personal things at times. But what do you think about in New York, where we don't drive to work, most of us anyway, we take public transportation. In the past, people used to read the newspaper or talk with each other. And now more and more you see people, even if they're together, listening to their iPods.
Yeah, you know, I don't think technology is necessarily the villain. There's a wonderful historian named Zeldin who says that it takes a while to learn discretion when something new. When gin was invented in London, people got falling down drunk and killed themselves because they drank it like they would have consumed beer or ale. And gradually discretion is learned. So, I don't think it's that it's the iPod or the laptop. I think that we haven't yet learned discretion. As we know how to read a newspaper with discretion, but we don't seem to know with iPods and cell phones. And, we didn't learn with boom boxes. Thank God they've gone. But, it takes time to learn how to use some innovative product, and in many cases we haven't learned that yet. Leave the BlackBerry at home. It's not appropriate.
Well, I love when I see a couple walking down the street together and each one is on a cell phone talking to somebody else. That's a weird kind of date. Let's go to Claire from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I feel like the village historian, but I'm presumably much older than Professor Godbey, and I entered the field at a time when it was still called recreation or recreation education or recreation and related community services. And one of the first things that one does, rather than thinking of leisure as an ephemeral term, taking apart the word recreation into recreation and what happens to the psyche when the normal workaday rituals are interrupted by a pleasurable experience, reading something, hearing a beautiful piece of music, and losing the sense of time that one has the rest of the time. In the late 60s and early 70s, the leisure ed programs proliferated around the country because there was a mistaken thought that the work week was getting shorter and vacations would be getting longer and people wouldn't know what to do with their free time. The emphasis on team sports, which one cannot always carry into one's old age. There's a whole history behind this. To me, when the word leisure studies came in, I found it rather disturbing because it sounded even stranger than getting a degree in therapeutic recreation, for instance, which was working with people with some physical or social disability and helping them to find ways of using their time pleasurably in a meaningful way, not teaching a child who's in a residential center to play in a fife and drum corps for fun when he then goes to a community where there is no fife and drum corps. And that,
Professor Godbey?
Well, your caller is obviously a part of the, can be called recreation management or leisure studies. And I agree with much of what she's saying. If there were something I didn't agree with, it might be that in a funny way, people actually spend a smaller percentage of the total hours of their life at work by far than they did 30 years ago. What we have done is store most of that at the back end of life called retirement. That's beginning to change, but we haven't had policies that have guided, free time and when it would occur and on what basis. And so I think she makes excellent points.
And it's interesting you mentioned retirement because Barry from Manhattan, our next caller, wants to talk about that. First, I want to say that this is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. My guest is Jeff Godbey, professor of leisure studies at Pennsylvania State University. It should be recreation studies, according to our last caller, but it's leisure studies. And we are taking your calls at 212-433-9692. Barry from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello. I was just wondering how the how your guest would relate what people do during their vacation time to what they do when they are retired. Are the two things, is there any similarity between the two areas of activity? I mean, I realize when one is retired, which I am, I retired 2 years ago, I realize that one may not have the health or the physical dexterity to do all the things one did when one was younger and working, but there are still a great many things which I wished to do while I was working, and which I had to cram into a few free hours on weekends and after work in the evenings. Now I can do a lot of those things. Those things seem to expand, and I do them more leisurely and with more
such as
pleasure.
Such as, Barry?
Such as travel, reading, going to the theater. And I think the main thing is being in touch with and seeing friends. I spend more time having luncheons with friends, having dinners with friends, and having long, long telephone conversations with friends nearly every day.
Well, Barry sounds like he's using his time well, but an awful lot of people, when they retire, simply sit in front of the television or do other things of that sort. You have that range. Is this the hierarchy you were talking about? People who play golf and tennis and read a lot and visit with friends and do all of that, and the others who just sit around and kill time?
Sure. I mean, I think that, you know, your caller sounds to me like someone who has not retired, and so to speak, but has shifted the way he lives. And of course, vacations are different from retirement, in that in the back of the person's mind, they understand this is temporary and they're going back to the same situation. The benefit of the vacation is they may find different aspects of life that they didn't know existed, and it's temporary and fleeting, but it refreshes and restores. Retirement is really preparing for a new way of life.
We go now to Pamela from Queens. Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning. And I'm commenting as a teacher, and of course your guest is a professor and is a teacher also. And I'm wondering about how you feel with the increase of assignments that are given to students, particularly on the high school secondary level, to the point where many have commented concern about their summer vacations being taken away from them. Many students are now going to schools, to classes, taking very special projects that go well into the summer vacation break, to the point where by the end of it all, they're so tired that they can't even begin the September session. So I'm wondering how you feel about this seeming encroachment on their summer vacation, encroachment on their leisure time.
Yeah, I think I feel like I believe you probably do. There's a real dilemma here. On the one hand, the world is racing toward a knowledge economy, and there's going to be winners and losers in that, and it may not be, we may not be the winners. What seems to be neglected in the thinking of a lot in public education, I think, is that there is so much learned in play, because play is not unstructured. Play is self-structured. That means the children or the teenagers have to organize it themselves. And play has rules, either in advance or that are made up by the players. And it's a form of doing something yourself rather than, learning your own lessons rather than learning someone else's lessons. And play happens to be, there's a big developmental literature that would support the idea that play is important, and simply loading on more assignments and loading on, more compulsive activity, I think is often psychologically detrimental, physically detrimental. So I agree with what I think is your position.
But it even goes further. Universities look at what kids have done during their summer vacations, and if they've done an internship at a commendable place, that will score points. If they've had work experience, that will score points. And then some kids have no choice in the matter. They have to work during their summer vacations just to be able to get through the rest of the year.
Yeah, we've all become walking resumes, and it's the idea that we are what we do and nothing less and nothing more is a pretty dismal idea.
Well, how do we get around that? You're in the university system. You know that when an admissions officer is looking at an application, that's something that will be considered.
Yeah, it's we've got.
It won't be. He organized all the kids in the neighborhood to play sometimes. That's not going to score too many points.
No, we've gotten ourselves into a lot of traps that. You know, it's going to take us a while to get out of, but from what I can figure out, there is much more belief right now that this country needs to reform itself, that it needs to let people be people, that sense of community is lacking. It's kind of every person for themselves, and it's certainly more that way than I've seen in my at 63 than that I've seen in my career. And how we get out of this, I think, is partly political, and I think is partly acting on what we already know somewhere in our consciousness. I mean, we're treating children basically using marketing models. My parents didn't say, would you rather do this or that? My mother said, I'm going to teach you to play tennis at a public park. I said, I don't want to. She said, you're going. She gave me an old racket, hit balls to me. First day, I hated it. Second day, hated it. Third day, okay. Fourth day, I didn't come home for dinner. You know, and I think we have a lot to change.
What's your idea of a perfect vacation? Have you changed over the years as you've been studying vacations and leisure time?
Yeah, because people seem to go through a cycle with vacation at the first time. They want the familiar, and they still want Cokes, and they want to see what's on the prescribed list. And then gradually, with China, the Chinese will entertain you to death, and you'll come home and know nothing about China. So now, I want to talk to people through a translator. I want to see what they actually eat, you know, in non-fancy places. I want to see how they grow food. I want to test the local Chinese, what they call strong wine. So I think a lot of people on vacation eventually want to get a little closer and understand something about where they are.
I think one of the best vacations I ever had was one where just by accident I wound up staying with a family in Oaxaca. Normally you can go through a town like that and have no idea what's going on around you. You're just simply going to the museums, going to the restaurants, and seeing people in the street, but in this case, I actually saw how people lived, and I considered it one of the luckiest and most enriching vacations I ever had.
And from something like that, you get the memorable experience, you know, which in our culture is the only thing that can't be taken away from you, is you can still remember. First time I was on the Great Wall, I was feeling sorry for myself. It was smoggy and crowded, this and that. And I sat down, my colleagues went on walking down the wall, and a Chinese man went past me and waved to me, come on, keep walking, you know, don't worry about the steps, don't worry about this. And he was a double amputee, you know, so that image is in my mind the rest of my life.
Jeff Godbee is a professor of leisure studies at Pennsylvania State University. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the Leonard LoPate Show from WNYC New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other podcasts at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.